Accession number 20521, Reel 1.
Harry Garrett, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
Uxbridge.
Which year was this?
Oh, 1918.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Uxbridge?
No. We came to London. Very, very poor family. Father had velvet disease of the heart and consumption. The three of us, mother did her best, but she couldn't cope with us. So at the age of four, I went to Doc Bernardo's homes for about 3 years.
Whereabouts was that?
Over in Woodford Way.
How were you treated there?
Very well. Lovely home. Came home for about another few months and then into Norwood Children's Homes at Norwood for about another 2.5 years. Came home again. Things couldn't work out. Into Sidcup Homes at Sidcup for another two years, and my sister and my brother went there with me. And then sort of we tried to get our way on from then. The whole thing was very traumatic. We were very poor. We had no money at all. We used to have to go down to the relief to get 10 shillings to give us money for the week, you know, to live on, four of us, because Father was very, very ill. And then eventually, of course, I came 14 years of age and went to work.
Were you misbehaving at home?
No. No, I never misbehaved. I was adventurous, but never misbehaving, you know.
So this was 1932 when you left school?
That's right, yes, that's it.
Did you get a job?
Oh, yes, I got a job. I lived over a butcher shop in Lewisham, and the next door was a shoe repair shop, and I used to work in the shoe repair shop there, you know, mending the shoes and taking the repairs out. And then I eventually went up to the city, and I joined a very nice firm in the millinery trade, J. Cole Hats, and I was there for 41 years. Until I was retired from there.
Did you join TA before the war?
Yes, 1938. My brother and I both joined at Minette Road, Brixton. And we were 4 or 5 howitzer battery at the time. And then we were transferred into a 2-pound anti-tank gun battery.
Can you describe some of the training you got pre-war, please?
Oh, yes. We were at a camp once or twice a year. We used to get paid £5 for this. That was fantastic. £5. Okehampton was one of our best camps. I remember going down there on the ranges out in the Dartmoor and all around the area. Lark Hill, Borden Camp. You know, overall, we were very well trained, actually, as territorials. And we enjoyed our life. We were very proud of ourselves, I think we were. You know, because we were all smartly dressed in the old breeches and spurs and the old, you know, the old uniform. But quite nice. And then, of course, we were actually at Okehampton when we heard about Mr. Chamberlain saying that we are now at war with Germany. And we then sent that to Brixton, where we embodied and got ourselves sorted out. Then we sort of went to Southampton, over to
Cherbourg,
because all the units, the whole trade run from Dunkirk, from Cherbourg to England was like an M1, because all the boats were going over there, and then all the equipment was on the way down to North Africa, Lille in North France. So the troops came along, they picked up their gear and then transferred themselves up to there. Fortunately, I got a pain in my back, which they diagnosed as pleurisy. And so they sent me off to hospital. So while these boys are doing their hard work, I was in hospital. I touched it.
Don't worry.
I was in hospital. And for 3 whole weeks... I had a most marvellous time while the chaps were working hard their living. I was...
Sorry, you can leave that.
Okay. So eventually I... it's quite a story, this actually. This fellow, Jimmy James, was with me in this hospital. We were the only two troops at the time, and we then went to into Cherbourg and had a look around the town. And I said, well, we're off tomorrow back to Lille. So he said, oh, well, I've got to go back too, Harry. So I said, well, perhaps we'll travel together. So we travelled together up to Lille, a place called Lambesart when I was out there. Now, this is the most coincidental, but on the beach of Dunkirk, on the second day of Dunkirk, I'm in a trench with my brother, and walking along in front, there was a bunch of Royal Engineers, and there's my friend Jimmy James. And then I thought, oh dear, terrific. But there's a story attached to all this too about my rum and milk and all these sort of things, because I broke down in a warehouse on the beach. We went out there, I said to my brother, look after the trench, son. And I smashed this door open, this warehouse, and it was like Aladdin's cave. Neat rum, carnation milk, Norton and BSO motorbikes. So I went out and I picked up, half a dozen empty water bottles, these poor lads didn't need them. And I filled these up with rum. And after a while, of course, we were very, very inebriated. And we didn't give a damn what happened about the war. And then, as I say, this Jimmy came along with this crowd. And I gave him a bottle of rum. And they said, well, you stay with us, Jim. I said, we've got a lovely trench here. I said, you'll be... No, he said, I've got to go back. My sergeant major's watching me. I said, well, he might not make it, mate. He might not make it. I said, you stay here. We're waiting for a decent boat, because we've been in and out of the water quite a few times. And the hazard of the shooting and the bombing and the shelling was quite serious there, because it was so concentrated. You know, we had from Newport to Dunkirk, there must have been, 400,000 men on that beach. And really, it was a sitting duck's job, shooting, killing the blokes, no problem at all. So I went this trench, made this trench, and I stayed there safe. And then eventually, one day, we called in, there's the pier, and then there's the mole. This destroyer Wolsey came in up to the mole. This on the third day I was over there. And then we saw this ship. Come on, you lads, he said, come on, quick, next stop, Dover, he said, come on. The Wolsey, this was, by the way, it got sunk in 1944 in the Mediterranean. So we eventually jumped on this boat, and we got back after a hazardous journey to Dover. We bombed and shelled all the way over, but it was quite exciting, really, because you felt England was coming towards you. And we all brought our rifles back with us, and they were taken off us when we got to Dover. Then, of course, we just had a put on the side, and the NAFI people, the Salvation Army, everybody wanted to help us, because we're a pretty rugged lot, you know, frightened, at least, not frightened as much as scared, I suppose. We were in a sort of hectic time. We were frightened, but we were brave. Is that the right way of saying about it? Yes, I think that's a nice way of saying it. And eventually, we got on these trains, and we went to Aldershot, Farnham, everywhere, couldn't fill up because we were about the last day back from Dunkirk, you see, on the 3rd or 4th of June. I ended up in Cannock Chase, Staffordshire.
Could I just stop you there, and can I go back, please? When you heard the news that England was at war with Germany, how did you feel about it?
Oh, elated. Enjoyed it. Let's get home.
Why?
I don't know. We've never had a good liking with the Germans, have we, really? When we still remember the 1418 War. Don't forget, it was only 20 years before, wasn't it? And I think we thought we'd sort them out this time. We should have sorted them out last time. And we were looking forward to, you know, having a good show. We had quite a reasonable amount of equipment. Their equipment wasn't bad, but the French had the best army of the lot. They had a better army than the Germans. But it was all tucked away in the Maginot Line, firing just one way, you know, that way, not behind. As you know, they came over the top, didn't they?
What was the unit you went to France with?
52nd Anti-Tank Regiment, RA. And we were in the what they call the Fighting 5th Division under General Franklin.
And what was the regiment equipped with?
2-pound anti-tank guns. Pea shooters, we call them, because they're just about as good as pea shooters.
How How close did you have to get to a tank to use one of those?
Well, sometimes it's about 100 yards. And then, because the war in France in 39 was chaotic, because every time when he broke through to Belgium, because as you know, we wanted to go into Belgium, but he wanted to be neutral, King Leopold, but of course the Germans had a better idea and said no, because he just went through him like a dose of salts. And if we'd have gone through, I'm sure if we'd have gone through to Belgium in the first instance and dug our position on the other side, we would have had a much better chance of knocking Jerry out, because he couldn't have got past us, I don't think. But because he ran through Belgium and the forts in Belgium, we had no chance but to go. We consolidate the position, because I went through to Brussels on the first day that they invaded there, and we on a position in the canal, and suddenly we saw load of tanks coming down the road. So this guard said, look, we're not staying there, mate. He said, we've been told to retire. I said, well, I haven't been told to retire. So my sergeant said, I was only a guy in those days, by the way. He said, well, you better ask. So he got an officer, and he said, the guards are moving back, sir. So he said, well, we better go too, haven't we? So we backed up, and now all our fighting was getting into the line, firing a few shots, and then back again. Firing a few shots, and back again. You know, we never got consolidated, because we went from there to back to Lille, Lambassar, down to Amiens, Arras, and the Vimy Ridge. That's where we ended up down there. And then we heard the story of the evacuation from Dunkirk, Operation Dynamo. So what we did then, of course, was to make our way back. And because we were being fired at both sides as we came back. We had Germans at each side of us shelling and bombing us all the way through. It was pretty chaotic. Nobody knew where they were. Nobody knew where our position was. No general seemed to know what was going on, you know, but we all made our way back to Dunkirk. Well, when we got to Dunkirk, we were holding a line outside Dunkirk, and then the General Gort, he said, there's too many troops here. So General Franklin's division was told to get on the beach and make their way to the beaches to get home, you see. So luckily we were in that mob, and we did, otherwise if we'd stay behind, I'd probably been a prisoner of war. But we were very disappointed. I mean, we wanted to fight, but of course you can fight with nothing. We had nothing, because all the arms had been destroyed, all the vehicles destroyed. We had to blow all the vehicles up, spike all the guns. And we got on the beach, all we had was just our own rifles and brain guns.
And you said you got pleurisy. At what stage did you get pleurisy?
Well, I got this when I was on the way over to France, on my initial going over.
Where did you go to hospital for treatment?
In Cherbourg General Hospital.
What was the treatment like?
Oh, beautiful, wasn't it? An old swaddy with waiting for all these lovely nurses looking out, these French nurses gave us the treatment.
How do you think you'd got pleurisy?
I got a chill, I think. I got a bad chill, because I was on the, we must have been on the boat for two nights, you know, going across, because there was so much vehicles, buses trying to get into the port. You had to wait your chance to get in. And I was on what they call submarine watch, so looking out for subs and these MTBs. And I think I got this awful pain in my back. I think I got a chill, and this is what they diagnosed. But in 3 weeks, I was better. So it wasn't all that serious, was it?
What do you know what month you went to France in?
November, I think it is. I've got a paper in there, but...
No, that's all right. Don't worry.
October, November, was it?
And you spent that winter at Lambassar?
At Lambassar, yeah, yes.
What was that like?
Very good, because we had gun positions. Tell it! We had gun positions in fields, you know, for ACAC and all that sort of thing. And it was a pretty cushy job, you know. We had the odd fighter come across, or bomber, but nothing serious. We had no war.
So this was Lambassar, was it?
Yes, it's an offshoot of Lille. It's like Riverhead being Sevenoaks, that sort of thing. A lovely, lovely place. We were in a chateau there, you know, a smashing chateau. Oh, in Lambesart.
All your regiment?
Yes. Very nice, but it was indeed.
Were you comfortable?
Oh, very much, yes. Oh, yes.
How did you get on with the local French?
Quite well. I think that I did a bit of French at school, a little bit, and it helped me quite a bit in a way, I suppose. But they were pretty easy enough to get on with, I think. We knew what that we wanted, and they knew what they were going to let us have.
Did you suffer from the cold in the winter?
That was a very cold winter, 1939 winter. It was a shocking cold, because I remember we were in the field. We had a big gun position there with our AKAC gun, our Bren gun, and it was freezing cold. I've never been so cold in my life without there. Great coats wrapped up, but never mind.
Were you surprised that there was no action during that winter?
Very surprised indeed. Well, I was safe, from November, December, right until May, doing really nothing. Obviously, you got bombed here and there, bombed here and there, but it was very sporadic, because we weren't really up the line. We were on the waiting for Jerry to come through Belgium, where we were.
Did you have a session in the Maginot Line?
No. We saw it, and that's about all we say we did.
Did you see anything of French troops?
Oh, quite a few French. French were with us most of the time. We had French and Belgian troops, and then because after the first week, I think the Belgians packed it in. They just, you know, they're overrun by the Germans, and we saw the Belgians on the side of the road, and I couldn't believe it, because remembering the epic and the fantastic Belgians in the 1914-18 war, I couldn't possibly conceive that they'd give in, you see, but they did, and made our job much harder, of course. And then, of course, we've got to run from there on, run, right round down to Vimy Ridge, and then back up to Dunkirk from there.
What impression did the French and Belgian troops make from the point of view?
Well, they thought we'd let them down, and we thought they'd let us down. But, of course, our general's orders were make back to England, and we came back, obviously, expecting to go back again. We fully intended that the war hadn't finished for us. We were going to re-invade. In fact, I think there's a 52nd Lowland Division was ready to go into...
Brest?
No, a little way along. Oh, dear.
Bordeaux?
No.
Le Havre?
Where the Highland Div was. St. Valery. There, and they were sent back on the boats. They weren't allowed to land because they could knew it as the job was too difficult.
Can you tell me about getting the news that the Germans had attacked on the 10th of May, please?
Well, it was very frightening, really, but we were quite thrilled to think we were going to get stuck into them. That's what we felt. You know, we were looking forward to it in a way, because we felt, you know, we were the king's whiskers, but we weren't actually, because I think it was about 10 to 1 time we got through, because, I say, every position we had, we went forward, held it for a while, and then the arms were so superior against the bit of loot that we had that we had to go back each time. And it was really just a fight and run. This happened all the way through right till we got to Dunkirk. But I said, we did feel that we were going to go back, but of course we didn't do that a long time ago. But we all say this, and of course all the historians say this, that had we been captured on the beaches, that 400,000 men, England would have been in a different sort of state than it was. And of course the fact that we came home stabilised the situation as far as the manhood of the country was concerned. Again, we thank the Dunkirk veterans for coming back. In a way, that was our own opinion, but it's very well read and thought by certain people.
What kind of reception did you get when you moved into Belgium?
Liberators, oh yes, so please, oh yes, oh help us. But then a lot of fifth column work out there was too, you know, because a lot of the Belgians collaborated out there with the Germans, and it wasn't very hopeful. Everybody you thought was probably a fifth column.
Did you ever find any fifth columnists?
Yes, we found a couple. We actually heard, I didn't know this, but apparently they had about five sort of nuns and priests were being dropped down by aircraft, and I understand they were shot. They were you know, going to spread their rumours amongst the Belgian people.
Can you tell me about the fifth columnist that you found?
Well, we just reported them to the police, as we thought. You know, they just took them away and that was it. We didn't. I think we could have quite easily shot them if we wanted to.
What had aroused your suspicions?
Well, just the furtiveness of them, you know, looking round and all that sort of thing. We were told to keep observant. I mean, it's like be quiet, don't tell, and all those sort of things. It was drummed into us all right way through, wasn't it, as far as the secrets was concerned. Don't talk about anything and all that.
Were they in cities?
I would think pretty well general.
No, I mean these two that you...
It was out at... well, it's on the way to Brussels, actually. This is what happened. Because the actual situation out there, you can probably imagine it. It was absolutely dreadful. Every road was full of civilians, horses, cars, coaches, and we had a most difficult job to get to our destinations to fight, you know, because we couldn't get through the public. And of course, Jerry made advantage of it because he used to bomb the civilians as well as the troops. So there was no quarter. It was a very sad thing to see people being killed on the roads. It wasn't a very clean war, that's a very dirty war. I thought it was one at all place for the situation.
How far into Belgium did you get? What was the farthest point?
We went right through to Brussels.
Did you go beyond Brussels?
No. we actually, I didn't go into Brussels. We were on the canal outside Brussels, and we had to... consolidate our gun position there until, as I said, these guards came through and told us that the Germans were behind them and move quick, which we did.
But when you were firing your anti-tank guns, what kind of targets did you...
Well, we were firing at lorries, in effect, sometimes. We fired at a couple of lorries, and one morning we had a very, very difficult situation. We were told that if tanks came at us with their guns pointing forward, they were Germans. If their guns were pointed rearwards, they were friendly. Well, this morning, around about 4:30, my sergeant, Sergeant Grover, he said, "Listen, Harry," he said, "there's tanks coming. Hold it," he said, "take post, take post." So we all took post there, and we had about 8 guns altogether in this box. And suddenly he said, "The tanks have got their guns pointing forward, they're Germans." So we opened fire, obviously. He said, "Fire, fire," because I was a layer on my gun. That means I got the shots up. I hit this tank in the wheels, and it actually stopped. But the other ones are so big, the shells bounced off them. It just went, you know. They were the biggest tanks in the war. They were 100-ton French tanks. The biggest tanks I've ever seen in my life. And when they eventually got there, the officer in charge cried his eyes out, really. He was very sorry that he'd fired at us, because we had 2-pounders and he had 75 millimetres. Not a difference, 3 times a shot. And we had quite a few casualties, and I understand we had about 17 casualties in the area where these tanks fired at us. But then it was all put right in the end, because they found out they were French tanks. But they shouldn't have been there anyhow. Had they should have been, their guns should have been pointing backwards. But then if you're going into action, you don't want your guns pointing backwards, do you?
Was it one of the French officers who wept?
Oh, yes, this chap in charge of the French. He was very sorry, because we had a few bodies and boys lying about. My bombardier was very badly shot up. It was all chaos, really. You know, you can't believe we muddled through this in some ways. The true Brit.
Did any casualties inflicted on the French tank men?
Not really, I don't think, because we you know, there might have been one or two shocked up. I mean, the tank we stopped with that track, that was just mobile for a while, and it stopped, and then they repaired it, and when they drove off.
Do you know where that was?
I have no idea now. No, I know it was on the way back from Vimy Ridge, because we fought an action in the Vimy Ridge Cemetery there, you know, as well.
Can you tell me about that, please?
It was a very hairy business, because we were told to make a gun position there, and we my gun was in amongst all the First World War soldiers' graves, you know. And it was a sad thing to see these shells coming over and blowing these stones up on the graves. And they had fixed line firing, which means they had a line of fire on the road and you know, firing like that. So you had to judge your time when you got out quick, opt across the road out of the way. But then we got shifted from there on the way up to Dunkirk.
Were you wounded at all?
No. I was blown up a couple of times, but that's shock. You know, just had shock, that's all.
How did that come about, being blown up?
Well, you just... it's a hazard, that, you know, there's so much of it going on. If you can imagine that the beach particularly, with all those troops around, and the Germans 12 miles away, static positions, firing and just firing away ad lib, plus the bombers coming over and the fighters driving the beaches, it was actually, as I said on my recording, I said, I've been through hell and I hope we go to heaven when I die. That's what I mentioned on the BBC programme. Because it was very, very hairy indeed, it was.
So you got blown up by bombs on Dunkirk Bay?
Oh yes, we had one drop, I should think, but with that trees and the garden there. And lucky, because of the situation, I mean, it was very, very sandy, the beach. Have you seen the Dunkirk beach, have you? You know, there's a picture of it there, that Japan, and it goes out to about a quarter mile of sand once the tide's out. And we thank God for that, because the 400,000 troops from Newport to Dunkirk, they would, as the bombers come over, you see all the men just like ants, you know, they scatter, bray dunes and all around there. It was most amazing. But there were a lot of casualties before. My good friend, he made me laugh with it. It wasn't funny at all. This fighter came down the strafing all the way along the line. He jumped in a trench and he fell on the bloke. He said, "I'm sorry, mate." He said, "When the fighter had gone up, he'd been dead. He'd been killed long before."
But before that, you'd been on the Dunkirk perimeter.
Oh yes. We were holding a line outside on the canal, outside, and then we were told to disengage and destroy our guns and our vehicles and then make our way to the beaches from there. But then, luckily, I don't know why, but my brother and I and Abby Lee, that's the boy up there, we got, I should think, within about 150 yards of the mole. And I came up, if that's the sand here, I dug a trench up here at the top and I filled it with wood boxes and things to stop the sand falling on top of us. And that was our little haven until we got back to, the destroyer. And that's, it was most amazing. But when we did destroy all our vehicles, but in that... warehouse where I told you there's Norton and BSA motorbikes. On the second day after we got our rum and rations and all that sort of thing and carnation milk, incidentally I wrote to Carnation Milk and told them what a wonderful thing it was to have rum and milk when we hadn't got any water to drink. What a story, they're quite pleased with that story. But we saw chaps doing speedway, you know, the old dirt track racing on the sands. Oh, about 300 yards away from us on the way to Bray Dunes, these chaps riding around the sands on their motorbikes, and then when the bombers came over, they lay flat down there and you know, get up again and race around there. Oh, it was a wonderful sight to see what, you know, the fire in these men, they just couldn't care less.
You mean they were just playing?
Well, they were enjoying life because it's so unreal. I mean, you think that you've got the whole army there and it's just going to be obliterated, really, because I mean, Goring thought he was going to blow us all to pieces, didn't he? That was the intention, but it didn't come off that way. But we, as you know, we lost, many great ships and boats out there. But that destroyer, Wolsey, was a fantastic trip to me when we went home on it. Oh, dear. Must have been about 400 on it, I think. Packed like a sardine can, it was.
Did they do anything for you on board ship?
I don't really remember. I think we were busy firing our guns at the Germans. I mean, I had my rifle and plenty of bullets, And every time a plane came over, I think you got about 300 or 400 rifles and machine guns firing at these planes as they came over. And that kept you occupied. And because when we got back to Dover, we got plenty to eat then, sandwiches and coffee and tea and beer and cigarettes.
When you were...